Exit number 12033, Reel 4.
The Reverend Gordon Wilson, Reel 4.
This man that I was talking about, who had worked on the railway, come up from Rugby to Crewe, wanted to find a church where he could be at home, and heard me preaching on Remembrance Day, what was really a pacifist message, felt that this was a church he wanted to belong to, and he became a staunch friend. He told me that he was in the airborne forces, and he was in a glider going to Arnhem, and while he was sitting in the glider going to Arnhem, he felt that his Christian faith came right home to him, and he felt that from now then onwards, Jesus Christ would have to really mean something to him. He couldn't just treat it formally. And then during the Battle of Arnhem, he became a prisoner and was taken to a prison camp in Germany. During the time of those months till the end of the war, there was a great shortage of food, and he suffered deprivation. And at one point, very nearly starved to death, he talked about when they were on a long march going towards Italy, going right across Europe. And he told me about how he had, for the first time in his life, seen one man kill another man with his bare hands. And he said they were given a loaf of bread, and that loaf had been cut into 8 slices, one slice for each member of the group that they were in. And one of the group grabbed an extra slice, and the other man, who was a non-commissioned officer of some kind, went to him and with the side of his hand gave him what I think they call a rabbit punch on the neck and killed him. And this sort of illustrated the awfulness of desperate hunger and the plight that people were in together. And that had made a great impression on him. The other thing that had made an impression on him was the fact that some of those who had been the most, what we call gung-ho about their attitude towards the military and so on, lined up the troops in Arnhem. He always remembered an officer lining up the troops and saying, we will maintain our military discipline, and then the attack starting. And he said this man just crumpled and collapsed, whereas the people who really came through during his time in the prisoner of war camp were the sort of people who in a local society would have been regarded as the awkward ones, the boys who would always be in trouble and so on. And yet they were resourceful in the prisoner of war camp and became a tower of strength to whom everybody turned. Lessons like that he learnt. He's really learnt right deep down about the basics of life, and that was what brought him to Crewe and gave him a kind of kinship with me. And we in the course of time became very staunch friends indeed. I told him about my attitude towards the war and so on. We talked about pacifism, and we've had a very close identity. He always, right up to his death, which was only a couple of years ago, he always used to describe me as his best friend. And the last time I saw him was when he came over to this house and shared in our Ruby wedding celebrations. We were very, very close indeed, and we're still close with his wife in Selby, where he was moved by the railway. And we didn't sort of hide any of the aspects of the kind of discussion about war and violence and Christian attitude towards it. We discussed these things together, and we shared a very common attitude towards what the Christian response ought to be. I don't think he ever got to the point of calling himself a pacifist, but he gave expression to ideas which were so close to mine that there wasn't any difference. And talking about the airborne forces, there was another man who was a paratrooper during the war, who always says the only time he's ever been to Germany was at the end of a parachute with a Tommy gun stuck in his belt when he landed at, I think the bridge is called Remagen on the Rhine. He went over the bridge and landed on the far side, on the German side. And he came back to England and wanted to be ordained and was preparing, became a curate in some parish on the Thames estuary, on the Essex side. And during the Suez crisis in 1956, he had been studying the just war theology, and he felt that what was happening at the time of Suez didn't fit into the just war ideas, and felt there was something wrong. And there was another incident that came to Remembrance Sunday, and at the end of the service, the server, who was a member of the Anglican Pacifist Fellowship, known to my friend as such, said to him, "But Father, you didn't pray for the enemy dead." And that made my friend Sidney think. If he was going to pray for the dead in war, he'd pray for all the victims of war, not just for our own side, even though they were his comrades. And that started his thought processes, and so he wrote off to ask the secretary of the Anglican Pacifist Fellowship for literature. And as a consequence of that, he joined the society and eventually became the secretary of it, and became what I once described him as, like Peter. He became like a rock, a tower of strength, another expression. He was absolutely strong in his theology and in his attitude towards pacifism. He is, if anything, a more complete pacifist than I am, if that's possible. And he is now in New Zealand conducting a mission at the invitation of the New Zealand Anglican Pacifist Fellowship, whom I know because my brother lives in New Zealand now, and we go over there from time to time. I know most of the people there, and in a way I perhaps played a part in an invitation for Sidney to go and conduct this mission. He's travelling round all over New Zealand. Having started in February, he will finish in November, when my wife and I hope to go out there to join him at his last retreat and conference early in November. Also, incidentally, to see my brother and his wife, and also to see our son and his wife, and our two little grandchildren out there. But Sidney is doing this.
What is his name?
Sidney Hinks.
And what was the railway man's name?
The railway man's name was George Fairhurst. George Fairhurst. Been railway man all his life, and was absolutely imbued in railway, living in Crewe. His father had been a signalman. And he was a very strong, sturdy character. And I felt a great joy in our friendship, because I felt we'd been drawn together. We're starting from very different points. We come to a common point in the middle, which was a sharing of the Christian faith, which meant a great deal to us both. It was because it meant a great deal to us both that our friendship fostered. And as I say, his wife, now living as a widow in Selby, is constantly in touch with us, and she is a very, very close friend too. So I think that rather gives the lie to what the Bishop of Sheffield had said to me, that I would have no influence with men. Both George Fairhurst, who was a great friend, and Sidney Hinks, who became a very, very, and is still a very close friend, are the opposite extremes of what the Bishop of Sheffield had in mind. They didn't turn against somebody like me because I hadn't taken the same way that they had taken, but because the way that they had taken had brought them really face to face with the realities of life and death and of the Christian faith. The Christian faith had to mean something to them. So they found in their friendship with me a point where the Christian faith could be shared at a much deeper level than is normally the case. I'm sure that is true of both George Fairhurst and Sidney Hinks, both of whom have that wartime background, and both of whom had that sense of comradeship, which was given expression by our other friend who was called up and apologised for wearing the uniform because he couldn't go against his mates. I think that's a very important thing. The comradeship of the services is very meaningful. And I would never denigrate the forces as such when the television had a programme about Remembrance Day and what should be the attitude towards Remembrance Day, and they asked me to take part in it. Well, I couldn't go in the end because I'd had a little illness, which my doctor thought I shouldn't be. I should say no to the BBC What I would have said on that occasion, it was David Jacobs who was in the chair of that, I would have said that Remembrance Day may fade out as people get older and older and die off, but we should let it happen that way. I would have referred to what I mentioned earlier about the impression that Armistice Day used to make on me with the 2 minutes silence, and the remembrance of what people had been through is a sacred thing, and I feel that we should give honour to that memory and not do anything that denigrates it in any way at all. I feel a sense of identity, almost from my point of view, with that kind of comradeship in a way that I shouldn't want to sever, so that it's the memory of people like George and Sydney in the war and many others with whom I shared an identity that I should want to honour on Remembrance Day. And I would want to keep that going as long as such people are alive and not do anything drastic to change it. The Week of Prayer for World Peace we thought of in terms of having it during Remembrance Time. Then we decided in discussions with Canon Carpenter and others that that would turn our vision backwards. We didn't want to be looking back all the time. We wanted to look forward and think of what is being done positively to create peace in the world. And we thought of the United Nations. United Nations Day is the 24th of October. So the Week of Prayer for World Peace is always the week, Sunday to Sunday, which includes the 24th of October. And that is done deliberately to focus our gaze towards the positive aspect of peacemaking instead of looking back towards the memories of war. And although it's roughly at that time of the year, and people say, why is it that time of the year? My answer is always to identify it with the United Nations. And so 24th of October forms the centre of the week each time. And we have links with things like the United Nations organisations. Their groups send for copies of the prayer leaflet and join in the activities. And I think it's right that we should look forward in that way and be positive and not just look back. But looking back to the memory is something which I still regard as sacred, but not necessarily the focus for the Week of Prayer for World Peace. I honour the memory of those who've been through this experience of war. Some drawn into it, like my railway porter friend, somewhat reluctantly and yet getting more and more identified with it. The story of people in the forces during the war was the human story. People didn't go rushing and volunteering. They were usually called up. Some went reluctantly, some went with misgivings, and some went accepting it, fatalistically almost. But it didn't cause a division between those who had felt the need to stand at a tribunal and make their witness in a different direction. When I went to college, I, for the first time, on the doorstep of the college, I felt moved to take my badge off, or we say no, because I thought, I'm going into a close community. I don't want to be a divisive element in the community. But they very quickly all knew what I stood for. In those days, people tended to join the NFS, National Fire Service, which had been the AFS, the Auxiliary Fire Service, originally. At my tribunal, they asked me about getting involved in ambulance work and so on, and I gave the answer that I didn't want to become part of the organisation. But once I'd had my tribunal, and then they'd come to that decision, and I felt free to decide what I should do, I went to the local ARP station in where I lived at home and volunteered to go and help them during the vacations, and they told me that I wouldn't be any help to them vacation time. I wouldn't be any good, so I didn't join there. But then at college we had the Baedeker raids, when the places like Durham seemed to be likely targets of Durham Cathedral, and I joined the local ARP group and used to go off to the ARP station to spend the night in the little room there, and wore a uniform, a great coat and boots and things. Didn't do very much, but I became qualified for the General Service Medal, which they sent me at the end of the war. So I have a medal. Can't put my hand on this at the moment, but it's, you know, the general thing. That was a result of being part of the ARP.
There was no dilemma for you in being part of that?
No. By then I felt that I was helping the community. I wasn't helping the war effort. So that, no, I was quite happy to do that.
Did you have many debates in college? You know, you mentioned earlier the concept of a just war, and I wondered, you know, if you had would have had debates about
we
the
did
nature
have
of World War II and whether that came under this heading of just war.
Well, we did have quite a number of debates of that kind, yes. And people used to sort of come out with the kind of argument that the war against Hitler was a surgical operation, and I used to sort of say, well, you don't carry out a surgical operation with a rusty nail. And all that sort of argument that students have and discussions. But they all knew what my position was, and I was very happily a member of the community there. And also when I went to Cambridge later, during the time when all the planes were going over to Arnhem, but little unknown to me, my friend was probably going over in a glider over the Cambridge that I was at as a student. There were terrible times, obviously, and it was terribly difficult to be in a quiet, sequestered area when all this was going on. One didn't just sort of happily accept it. One was very troubled about all the tensions that were involved. No doubt at all that I remember readings in chapel that used to sort of come home to me very much in those days, with their relevance to the actual conflict that was taking place. We had students at Durham who were preparing to be Air Force pilots, or Air Force cadets as they were called, and a lot of those were quite good friends. We used to play hockey together. So that we had great friendship there.
Did the church's position in World War II, you know, the established church, worry you at all, the fact that there was sort of support for the war?
Yes, it did, certainly did. I remember engaging in debate with Archbishop Temple, William Temple, who was then Archbishop of York, and came up to Durham to talk to the students, and we had a meeting on a Sunday evening when he gave an address on these subjects, and I remember asking questions about our loyalty to the way of Christ and the demands of the state and so on. And he was a very, very brilliant speaker and a very articulate, the most we've ever had, I suppose, in the Church of England. The other one who had a great influence was Michael Ramsay, who was my professor at Durham. And we used to have discussions with him, and I think his views have sort of gradually changed over the years. He's probably been influenced by some of the ideas that we put forward. I think he seemed to indicate sometimes that he felt there was there were things that he had to take account of. But he again is a brilliant, or was a brilliant mind, and somebody had a very acute appreciation of what Christian theology really was. Great influence again. And in a personal influence in the sense that when I'd gone to college, having gone straight from the office, my time from school had been about 5 years and there was a gap. And they put me onto what they call a past degree course. Well, they called it divinity group. You concentrate on some divinity subjects and then took an ordinary past degree. At the end of the first year, I'd done reasonably well, in spite of having missed those 5 or 6 years from school, and had won the prize in the first year exams. And Michael Ramsay felt that I ought to go on to an honours degree, And he went to tell my principal what he thought. And my principal was one of the old-fashioned type that thought a pastor's degree was good for any ordinary parish priest and no need for any of this nonsense about honours degrees. And he argued. And I remember Michael Ramsay coming out of his house with a very red face as a result of this discussion. And just saying to me, "You'll start in the honours school on Monday." And I always thought that was a very important moment in my life. It was something, the kind action that Michael Ramsay did for me, which made a great influence, because I obviously took to the honours school much more than I took to the pastor's degree, and did reasonably well, getting a top second in the end. And I was owe that to Michael Ramsay, and I felt that he had a good influence, apart from the lecturing that he gave us, the insight into the New Testament which he gave, which was absolutely wonderful. But we did have discussions in the students about these general subjects, apart from their preaching, and my attitude towards what was happening in the church and in the war was that it was an awful contrast, which was wrong, and there was something deeply wrong about the situation, which we've been saying ever since and still saying now, which I think has found expression in things like the Lambeth Conference, as I quoted the 1978 conference to you, and it has come up each year. There's an uneasy conscience in the church about it all. They know that the way of Jesus, in point of fact, was a pacifist way, as we would now put it. And they also know that the church is very deeply ingrained in the community life, and that there are contrasts there which need to be resolved. And so there's that uneasiness which finds expression in occasions when you are able to draw attention to them, which we regard it as our job to do in the Anglican Pacifist Fellowship. We believe that our first loyalty is to the church and to Jesus Christ, which might make me bordering on religious mania, I don't know. That's what the tribunal thought. It's a question of priorities. If you say that your priority is in that kind of order, then people think you are a little bit fanatical. But I wouldn't have said that I was what people call a fanatical pacifist. I just feel that there's no alternative to the position that I had to take at that time. And I had to make my views known to the state. The state had provided the means of doing so through Winston Churchill's insistence. And it was right to take advantage of that and to go through the process of a tribunal and accept the consequences.
When you know, you think of the situation today and you look to the future, do you feel optimistic or pessimistic about the possibility of peace in the world?
Well, I must continue to be optimistic because I must believe that good will triumph. But I am realistic enough to know that is by no means easy and straightforward. And it will not be by any quick answers. There will be a hard and difficult way to a solution, just as I think the illustration is what's happening in Kurdistan at the moment. It's a very, very hard. Everybody knows what ought to happen. Not many people are quite clear about the right way that they should try and achieve that. And the way of witnessing to a prophetic vision is a way of great difficulty always, with many snags. And I think the prophet has to go on prophesying to what he believes to be true, regardless of the fact that he is dismissed as impractical and not realistic. That is the argument that is so often used, that amidst the harsh realities of this wicked world, but our Christian faith is that this wicked world was transformed and redeemed through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That is not my fanatical view. That is the official doctrine of the church. And I believe the church is not always true to that belief. I think it rather sort of puts it into the background and makes it into a kind of religious activity, sets the cross on the altar and venerates the cross, but doesn't necessarily accept that the way of the cross is the way that we should all follow in reality. And therefore, I would say that we are the true realists rather than those who dismiss us as being unrealistic. But it's the vision has got to be kept alive, and one's got to have hope for the future. One's got to believe that what the Pope said in Ireland is that this irresistible force must find its expression. And it will do so long as people are prepared to be committed to their faith in a real way and accept all the consequences. And all the consequences are not merely taking an attitude about war and violence. They can apply to things like involved in a monetary society and the demands of money in a society and sacrifices that have to be made. Tensions all the time that have to be faced. Anybody who accepts a Christian position is facing tension, whatever we do, and in every little aspect of life. And it's not all that different between being a conscientious objector and taking an attitude towards the economic situation in the country. The tensions have to be faced and resolved, I think. So in a way, that is the background to one's approach to the future. That society, the world, can be transformed, has been transformed. I think that the Lambeth Conference in 1978, that Jesus, by his death and resurrection, has already overcome all evil. He made evident that self-giving love, the way of the cross, is the way to reconciliation in all relationships and conflicts. There is a very great truth there, which we have to somehow apply. And therefore, the use of violence is contradictory to the gospel. Now, it's easy for a conference like the Lambeth Conference to come up with this beautiful expression of the belief of Christians. It's a very different thing to come back and apply it in society when they're in the House of Lords or in Parliament. They come up against what they regard as the difficulties. And I believe that the Church has got to overcome those difficulties, got to be true to its faith no matter what. And that's not being fanatical, I think. It may be that that is the crux of the thing about religious mania, I don't know. Maybe that that is the point of the thing, but one has to go on holding to the vision and believing that it is true and it must prevail and that there can be peace. And what I meet in other religions encourages me to believe that there are deeper things than we take into account very often that we can find if we look. So that I've got great friendships, human friendships, with Sikh families and even Muslim families. And as I say, like the incident in Peking, where this very distinguished Muslim teacher from Islamabad University was so passionately concerned about the human situation of the nuclear problem that I found a place of identity between his faith and my faith. And he gave expression to that by touching my arm and calling me his brother. That is one of the things which I learnt right at the beginning of World Conference on Religion and Peace, our first conference in Louvain in 1974. We were invited to share in the mass of the Women's College where we were staying, which is a Roman Catholic mass, and which was very beautifully conducted in beautiful French. And which meant a great deal. It made me feel that all these years we've so often sort of looked over the wall at different denominations. In point of fact, we are at the same point and we share a very close identity. And I felt that in this Mass. And at the end of the week, I said to the priest who'd been conducting it each day, I said to him in French, thank you, mon ami. And he put his hand on my arm and said, mon frère. Well, I think that we are brothers and sisters in the Church, and that when we really get down to it, like my friend in Crewe, George Fairhurst, we've got a very close identity. And I've found in places like Germany, Belgium, France, Italy, different places in Europe, when I've been invited to attend the Mass with the Roman Catholic community, that I've felt myself absolutely at one with them. Not any division at all. And I think that is true of the of the church. The name of that person I was trying to think of was George. I can't think of the surname. Silly, isn't it? It's the most familiar things disappear.
It just will come. I'm sure we can find that out. And thank you very much indeed, Reverend Wilson. That really has been most interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to have the conversation. I'm sure my dear wife would think I was being, as usual, garrulous and going on and on.
Oh, I don't think you can be accused of that.